are flush out of time, so to speak. And thank you so much. People can support you by coming out today from 4 to 8. You'll be there, and you'll be there for the next 4 days, right? Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you, Julia. And thank all you listeners. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Red Umbrella film series hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the film My Own Private Idaho will be shown Sunday, August 30th at 7 p.m. Directed by Gus Van Sant, My Own Private Idaho adapts Shakespeare's Henry IV story to friends and hustlers living on the streets of Portland. Again, that's My Own Private Idaho at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Looking for a career? KBOO is proud to be a co-sponsor of Oregon's 15th Annual Diversity Employment Day Career Fair. The fair will be held Wednesday, August 26th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Ambridge Events Center, located at 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. Participants may interview with over 50 major employers who are recruiting for hundreds of positions. The career fair is sponsored by the DiversityRecruitersNetwork.org. Business attire is required and bring plenty of resumes. More information is available at citycareerfair.com or on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:02, and it's time for Political Perspectives. We continue with morning programming this morning, beginning with Political Perspectives. Today, host Per Fagering follows up with economist Richard Wolff about Greece, austerity, Germany, cheap energy, capitalists leaving the U.S. for cheaper parts of the world, and also the broad attack on pensions for Americans. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15 on Flashpoints, a report from Brazil, where protesters are reportedly calling for the impeachment of the president, analysis of Black Lives Matter and the recent dialogues they've had with presidential candidates. And oil expert Antonia Juhas confirms that the war in Iraq was actually fought for oil and not for freedom. At 11 o'clock, it's the Food Show with Chris Siegel and Rachel Bennett. They speak with Kristen Olson, author of The Soil Will Save Us, with Richard, also with Richard Setnick of Dick's Kitchen about sustainable ranching, and also with Andrew Barton and Peter Schweitzer from Secret Restaurant about their new project. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can easily become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking where it says Donate Today. Now, please stay tuned for Per Fagering speaking with Richard Wolff.
And we are doing political perspectives, and our guest is sort of we are trying to contact right now is economics professor Richard Wolf, who was on the air a few weeks ago, and we had a very good discussion on all kinds of economic issues. And we are pleased to have him back. And we're going to talk about austerity, of course. That seems to be the big thing in Europe with Greece. In fact, this morning, the German Bundestag, I believe, approved the latest round of funds that supposedly go to Greece, but apparently they go not to Greece itself. They go to help Greece pay the banks. These are the banks that foisted some bad loans on Greece in the first place. But anyway, that is what our one of our topics is going to be. And this has a is very interesting. The other big thing that's been happening in Europe lately is this this mass migration that's been going on now for, boy, a year, 2 years. And, you know, people are drowning in the Mediterranean. And when they arrive in Europe, they're settled in, you know, these very temporary camps. And some of the countries are taking them in, not as many as keep coming. And it's obvious that the reason they keep coming, you look at the origin of most of these migrants, and it's from war-torn countries in Africa and the Middle East. So you could say this is a sort of a one of the consequences of these wars that have been going raging now for I don't know how long. And guess who has been pushing those wars? Well, not only the neocons and the war party in the United States, but the European countries have been going along with these wars too. And now one of the consequences is that these people fleeing these wars are going to Europe. And this is very similar to what's happening here in the United States. You know, the Republicans are screaming and yelling about, you know, migration to this country from Central America. Well, guess what, folks? Those people are fleeing the consequences of the wars we've been inflicting on Central America now ever since, well, gee whiz, going back to President Reagan. That was one of his big things was the war against Nicaragua, the wars in El Salvador, and it goes way back to 1954, the war in Guatemala, where we overthrew a democratically elected government and put in a warlord who did the bidding of the United Fruit Company. So this set the scene for what's going on now. These people, a lot of the people who are coming to this country are fleeing violence and poverty in their native countries, which was partly greatly inflicted on them by the United States. So this is something to keep in mind. I mean, if the most recent, you know, is a few years ago, Honduras had a coup, a democratically elected president was overthrown with the support of Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State at the time. And then they had a kind of a military guy took over, and they had some kind of a rigged election. And Honduras, which has always been as long as I can remember, it's kind of a battleground. It's been the base of CIA operations and drug operations. And we are, of course, the people who really suffer are the Hondurans themselves. And now they are, to get away, to escape that kind of hellish scene, they are coming to this country any way they can. And our Republican candidates are screaming about it. They don't mention that the whole situation was set up by their own favorite president, Mr. Ronald Reagan. So these are some of the things we can talk about. We are trying to get Richard Wolf right now. I sure hope we do. But we are trying. But in the meantime, if you have any questions out there in the... If you want to give us a call now, here is your chance. What do you think about austerity? What do you think about immigration? What do you think about what's going on in Puerto Rico? That's one of the things I want to ask Richard Wolff about is Puerto Rico, which is sort of in a bankrupt situation. And what about the attack on pensions that the Republicans keep pushing? So there's so many things going on. So if you want to give us a call, the number is 503-231-8187. So call in and we will, whatever happens, we have plenty of stuff to talk about. So give us a call. One thing I would like to talk about is that growth is slowing down everywhere. And it's slowing down in China. It's slowing down in Brazil. It's slowing down all over the place. And with all the debt that that governments and corporations and private people have accumulated, somewhere I read that the total amount of debt, total global debt for the year 2014 was $199 trillion. That's a huge amount of money to pay back. And those figures came from the McKinsey Global Institute. And that includes all kinds of debt. It includes the governments, includes corporations, it includes private credit card debt. It includes all kinds of things. And if there is no growth, if growth is slowing down, what happens if those debts don't get paid? Is there a kind of a domino effect? That's what we keep hearing, that one default leads to another and the whole system kind of collapses. And I've always wondered exactly what are sort of the details of that collapse? How would it actually work out in our daily lives? So if you have any thoughts on that, give us a call, 503-231-8187. Maybe what it comes down to is that maybe debt itself is something that cannot be sustained. Why do, you know, when we have a, say we have a bond measure on the ballot, you know, we're going to build a highway or earthquake-proof our schools or whatever, you know, we put a bond measure on the ballot and say the it's for $10 million. So the government, you know, the local government borrows this $10 million from some banks, and they do all these projects. And then for the next who knows how many years, they have to pay that money back with interest. And so by the time it gets fully paid off, that $10 million loan comes out to be more like, $15 million, $20 million. You know, it's, and so why do we have to finance our government that way? Why can't we, when we borrow $10 million from the banks, and then we spend it, we disperse it to various contractors and to do this work. Why do we have to go through the banks to do that? Why can't we sort of fund this ourselves? Let's see. Okay. A caller is asking for more background on Richard Wolff. Okay, well, he is an economist. He's a professor emeritus at, I have it right here, at New School University in New York, and he's written a lot of books. He has a website, and he's written books on capitalism, and he's a frequent guest on David Barsamian's alternative radio. He's the professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He's a visiting professor at the New School University, New York City. He also teaches classes at the Brecht Forum in Manhattan, which is pretty well known there. It's a been going on for quite a while. I guess it's sort of named after a poet, playwright Bertolt Brecht. And he's written a lot about these written on the Greek crisis, and he's written on austerity, which he's very much against, by the way. We should all be against austerity. At least if we're going to have austerity, it should be from the top down. If we're going to start squeezing salaries, why don't we start squeezing those million-dollar salaries that the corporate executives get? So that's who Richard Wolff is, and we are we are still trying to contact him. We have a couple phone numbers here, and we are working on it. But in the meantime, if you have anything you want to say or any questions you want to ask, give us a call at 503-231-8187. What do you think of the state of the world today? Do you think has austerity been hitting your pocketbook recently, or has it been has your life been kind of austere all along? This is this is something not brand new, I will say that. So give us a call while you have the chance, because we hope to contact Richard Wolff real soon. But in the meantime, we're going to keep on spreading the news and talking about the things that really matter. So this is the place to do it. This is KBOO, your radio station. That's why we are here. We are here to provide news and information that you don't get on the regular mainstream media. So the number to call is 503-231-8187. One of the things that I've been talking about for a while now, and it's not just me, that why is the economy slowing down? Well, the sort of among the economists, there seem to be two main schools of thought. You know, there are the Keynesians who they have government spending to kind of prime the pump to get the projects going. Of course, they put money into the economy and it circulates, and they hope that this will get things going. That, you know, one person's spending is another person's income, and that is as a kind of a virtuous cycle. And it worked in the New Deal back in the 30s. And they think that it can work now. Well, you know, the 30s is not the same as things are now. The U.S. government has been priming the pump, as they call it, quantitative easing, and then putting money into the economy. They've been the lending rate now is close to 0%, and it's produced some growth in this country, but not a whole lot. And so then why is it not working? The other school of thought is the austerity people, and they think that you have to cut budgets, you have to make government and everything pay for itself, and that this will free up the economy somehow, and that this will promote growth. Well, that hasn't worked either. The austerity that Greece has been inflicted on has had a horrible effect. More and more people are unemployed. Unemployed people don't really produce anything, do they? And so, neither of these recipes for growth have been very successful. The only thing you can say for the Keynesian model is that at least it's not cruel, it's not vicious. It aims to help ordinary folks like you and me. But whether it'll produce growth, probably not. And the reason is that the economy operates in a kind of a larger world, the world of nature. And what's happening is that cheap oil, we are using up the cheap oil. And since when oil becomes more expensive, it kind of ripples through the economy and makes it harder and harder to produce more. And so it makes growth, it kind of works against growth. And it's very interesting, what's been happening here lately is that the price of oil has been going down. And this is kind of an unusual situation. What's happened is that the price of oil, it got up to, several years ago, it got up to, I think, 147, Okay. Let's say we have a caller and we have Richard. Let's do the caller first. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Parrot. Hey, I love listening to Richard Wolff. But one of the things that I always get stuck on is that he and Gar Alperovitz often talk about workers' cooperatives as a kind of solution. And I just don't understand where the workers' leverage can come from with worker cooperatives. It seems like Wall Street is holding all the cards. Mm-hmm. And the French workers, when they go out on general strike and shut the country down, that seems to me like real leverage. I don't understand the worker cooperative as a model of regaining workers' leverage.
So. Okay, well, let's ask Richard Wolff that, because I think we have him on the line right now. Richard Wolff, are you there? Oh, he's not ready yet. Okay, whoops. Anyway, we have a nice dial tone to listen to. But how do workers' co-ops come into being? Where do they, what gives them their leverage? That is a good question that we will put to Richard Wolff when we get him. But getting back to energy, the price of oil went up to $147 a few years back, and then it suddenly crashed, went all the way down to, I believe, $40 a barrel or something. Then it went back up again to, I believe, about $110. And now it has crashed a second time. The last I heard, the price of oil was about $42 a barrel. And you hear some people saying it'll go even lower. Well, a very interesting thing has happened. We keep hearing about a big, an oil glut, mainly due to these shale oil fields in North Dakota and Texas, and that this has produced so much oil that the price has gone down. Well, that's not exactly what happened. For one thing, these oil wells in shale country, they deplete very quickly, and the actual, there's less new drilling all the time. What happens is that these companies that are drilling in North Dakota have gotten, they're operating on the basis of junk loans that they have to pay back. Well, if you got an oil well in the ground, even though it's not producing very much, you go and you get as much as you can, as much revenue as you can to keep paying off those loans. But eventually that oil is going to it's going to disappear. And so it was happening before was that the drillers, one well would kind of peter out and they'd move on to another one and another one. And you'd have the whole countryside dotted with these kind of diminishing oil wells. Well, it's sort of finally the total production or lack of production is catching up with these drillers. And so this glut is kind of disappearing before our very eyes. And it's gotten now so that if the price of oil goes over $70 a barrel, it kind of starts killing the economy. But if it goes way below $70 a barrel, it starts killing the oil companies because they cannot make a profit at that price. So we're in this very strange situation where we need the oil, but somehow we can't afford it. And how that works out is something I've been trying to find out for quite a while. And we have been hoping to get some guests on in the future who can talk more about that. It's a very anomalous situation, and it's sort of, we need, what it turns out, what it comes down to is that we do need oil, even though it's too expensive to cheat. We have Richard Wolff right now. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Per. Sorry for the mix-ups.
Oh, that's okay. We have one person called in already, and he asked about... his question was that you and Gar Alperovitz have been talking about worker co-ops, and he was asking how do the workers get the leverage to start a co-op? So I think that question we ought to keep in mind. But in the meantime, we we sort of maybe pick up a little bit where we left off a couple weeks ago with the Greece and its austerity hell that they're going through. Because just today the news was that the German Bundestag, I guess they approved this latest, I don't know what you want to call it, bailout to repay the banks. So can you want to talk about that?
Sure. The reason that the German Parliament decision was important, and yes, they did vote overwhelmingly to support this, is that this quote-unquote bailout is exactly what the German government of Angela Merkel wanted. That is, they wanted all along to save the German banks and the French private banks and the others by getting taxpayer money, Europeans' taxpayer money, funneled to Greece with the proviso that the Greeks would have to use it to pay back the banks for their loans. The reason the Greek government had way more loans than it could possibly pay back, which every economist that I know of, looking at their situation, knows to be the case, that they can't possibly pay that money back, is that those loans should never have been made. The loans were undertaken through a cabal of a very small number of people, leading private bankers on the one hand, especially German private banks, and a there's no nice way to say this, corrupt leadership of the Greek government that saw its political careers nicely financed by borrowing money from German and French and other banks, because that would allow the Greek government to provide things that its citizens wanted and that its businesses wanted without having to tax them, because the money could be secured instead by borrowing. This is a game that politicians around the world play. It is done every day by American mayors and governors and presidents and congresspersons, just like it's done everywhere else. But if you're a small, relatively poor country, then it is extremely dangerous to play this game, because eventually, if economic tides turn against you, you suddenly discover you can't pay these loans back.
What happens if the loans don't get paid? Do we have a kind of a domino effect where one bankruptcy leads to another? What would happen?
You know, exactly. If all you do is simply have the debtor, in this case, a Greek government, not pay its debts, yes, then that can lead to a chain reaction in which all the banks who expected to be repaid now don't get their repayments, so they in turn cannot make the payments they're obligated to make, and it becomes kind of like a chain reaction. We've gone through this. The modern capitalist economies have gone through this thousands of times in the last few years, one place or another. So we, in fact, have a great deal of experience. And what the experience has always taught is that you don't solve the problem of a debtor who can't pay by imposing on that debtor either the obligation to crunch themselves to death, stop functioning as an economic unit in order to pay off its debts, but what instead you do is help them to get back on their feet so that they can pay, if not the whole debt that they incurred, you have to help them to get on to pay at least a portion of it. In the United States, this is called bankruptcy proceeding. So, for example, if the city of Detroit finds itself unable to pay off its debts, which is what happened, it declares bankruptcy, which is what happens. And in the bankruptcy court, it is decided that the most important way to move forward from this sad situation is to help Detroit rebuild its economic system so that it can pay, let's say, half or 25% or some amount that a judge fixes, a portion of their payment. Because if you actually made Detroit pay off all of its debts, you would actually worsen the conditions in Detroit so badly that the consequences are worse then cutting your losses now, reducing the total outstanding debt. And so what should have happened in Greece is the same thing that is in fact happening with Detroit and indeed the many other American cities and towns that are now unable to pay their debts, going through bankruptcy, etc. The Germans didn't want that. The Germans wanted to force the Greeks to pay all of their debts or a huge portion of them. And the only way that the Greeks can do that is to take tax money that they raise from their people and use them not for the schools, not for the roads, not for the hospitals, not for all the things that the Greek people need, not only to survive, but also to rebuild their economy from the disastrous consequences that they've suffered from the global capitalist crash. Instead, all of that money that might have gone to help rebuild the Greek economy is going to be leaving Greece, a poor country, and flowing into the coffers of Germany, France, and the other countries that have provided most of the quote-unquote European credits. This is cruel. This is economic craziness. And it will make the gap between the rich countries of Europe, above all Germany on the one hand, and the poorer ones, Spain, Italy, Ireland, as well as Greece, the gap between them will get greater. The conflicts, tensions, and resentments in Europe will become more exaggerated. And this is the part of the world that has given us in the last 100 years two world wars based on differences like that. So it is something which, if you know a little bit of history, ought to scare the bejesus out of you.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that maybe the whole idea of debt is becoming outmoded? That I just read that the total global debt, this is for governments, corporations, consumers, everybody. Last year, the total global debt was $199 trillion. That comes from the McKinsey Global Institute. And that just seems like
absolutely.
An immense, maybe we need to find another way to do things besides going.
You know, of course, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows, as someone quite correctly wrote a few decades ago, Bob Dylan, the songwriter. We have been through these debt crises before. You know, Shakespeare writes, neither a borrower nor a lender be, because it's a relationship, debt is, that entraps both sides in a destructive mutual codependence that has dangerous social consequences. And we particularly have it in the public realm. You have, on the one hand, private bankers who stand to make tons of money by making advantageous loan deals with public officials. On the other hand, you have the public officials who are in this peculiar position that the more they can fund what they do as a mayor or a governor or a president or a prime minister, the more they can fund it by borrowing, the less they have to raise taxes from their constituents. And so you have the dishonest politicians, and we have them here in this country every bit as much as we have them anywhere else in the world, the dishonest politicians who borrow way too much because it feathers their own political careers, knowing that when the money becomes due, they will have gone on, hopefully, to higher office. They can borrow when they're in office, make themselves look good to their constituents, because they can use the borrowed money to provide all kinds of services without raising taxes. So they're the perfect partner for the unscrupulous banker who sees in the politician somebody who's willing to give them the sweetest imaginable deal for their loans. So they look good as bankers who lend. The politicians look good as the folks with money to spend without having to tax everybody. And then we all claim to be surprised and shocked when the amount of borrowing and lending under these bizarre circumstances turns out to be way more then the next generation can afford to repay plunging us into these kinds of disasters from Greece to Detroit and everywhere in between. We have to face a reality which Americans have such a hard time with, that we have an economic system, it has a name, capitalism, that produces these kinds of insane, chaotic, and extremely destructive effects all the time. And so we need to have the long overdue conversation in our country, whose basic definition is, can't we do better than a capitalism that confronts us over and over again with these dysfunctional outcomes that we bemoan but seem unable to understand? We're always looking for who the bad guy is. Oh, gee, the prime minister of Greece shouldn't have borrowed that money. Or, oh, gee, that banker shouldn't have made that loan. The problem is that the system keeps producing these people. And even after the culprits we've finger-pointed last year are gone, the new ones who replaced them, responding to the same network of rules and regulations and rewards and punishments, end up doing the same thing. When that keeps happening, it's the system that's the problem, not this or that individual, not this or that particular deal that was cut, but rather a system that keeps producing this absurd outcome time and again.
Well, one way that we can fight back is with workers' co-ops, which you have been talking about, and one of our listeners called in earlier and asked, how do workers' co-ops get the leverage? How do they get going?
Well, one of the reasons worker co-ops, I'll answer in a minute, but one of the reasons worker co-ops are part of the solution is because, as the name implies, many more people have to be involved in the basic decisions than is now the case. A deal cut between a huge bank, I don't know, I'll pick one, Citibank or Wells Fargo or any one of the major banks, a deal between that bank and a large corporation, again, just hypothetically, I'll pick one, General Motors. That is a deal that will involve billions of dollars, but it is made by a handful of people. Literally, 5 or 10 people are all that are involved in cutting that deal. That means you have the risk that the details of that deal will be advantageous to the individuals making it, but may not be advantageous to the hundreds of thousands of people who will be affected by that deal and how it works out. When you have a worker co-op, everybody in the enterprise has to be able to participate, vote yay or nay on any deal, including a borrowing. They're going to have many more people asking questions about what the problems and costs of the loan might be, whether there aren't alternative solutions to whatever the problems are that lead to the loan negotiations and so on. And it just opens the process up so that at the very least, you have the people who stand to lose by these deals able to participate in deciding whether or not to make them, rather than the situation we have now, which leaves it to a tiny number of people who, as I just finished explaining, feather their own nest, take care of their own interests, and let the chips fall on everybody else who was excluded from participating. That's what worker co-ops can avoid.
Well,
now,
I guess,
how do you get them started? Mm-hmm. Well, the answer is actually there are many ways to start a worker co-op. Let me give the example of probably the single most frequent situation. A company decides to close a factory or an office or a store, either because the family that started the business has no heirs, or at least none who want to continue the business, so the initial owner can't or doesn't want to continue, or perhaps the initial owner is selling the business to somebody else who doesn't want to keep this part of it going, or they're moving to another country. So what you have is an ongoing business with its employees but suddenly confronted by the loss of interest on the part of whoever started the business or owns it at this point. At that moment, an option arises which too many workers don't consider, namely that the workers themselves keep their business going by becoming their own employer, by taking over the enterprise, so it isn't anymore a capitalist enterprise in which other people own and run it, and the workers just come and do their jobs, but instead, the workers continue to do their jobs, but now have a second and additional job, namely that altogether, as a co-op, they own and operate the business. You might be surprised to learn that in many states in the United States, there are funds available from the state to help that situation resolve itself in the form of a workers' co-op. And the reason for that is not hard to see. The local community, like the state in which this community exists, has a direct material interest in a factory or an office or a store not closing, because if that happens, there will be unemployment. If that happens, the local business will no longer be paying taxes to the community where it's located, to the state in which it functions, and so on. The state doesn't want to lose the tax revenue, neither does the local community. They don't want to have the extra burden of providing unemployment insurance and food stamps to the workers who lose their job. So for the whole surrounding community, as well as for the workers in such a business, becoming a workers' co-op is a way better outcome than to simply slink away and leave the decision to close the enterprise that was made by the few people who own it to simply be the result without challenging it. Second example, workers who, even if they can't tap the government for funds to help them convert into a workers' co-op, they can go to other sources. For example, labor unions, in some cases, have the funds to help undertake a conversion, if you like, in which the members of a union threatened with losing their job hold on to their job by converting into a workers' co-op and using as necessary funds for it either grants or loans from unions or grants or loans from a local church. It's really the same thing as having a grant or a loan from a government agency. Local church doesn't want to lose its parishioners. The local union doesn't want to lose its members and its position in the community. So they all have an interest in keeping a business going. And if worker co-op is the way to get that done, then that's something they can and they will support. Finally, let me put it in a slightly different way. A worker co-op can go both to local politicians and to local bankers. And it can say something to them that's very persuasive. We face in our community, they can say, the risk that such and such a company goes out of business, closes shop, there will then be unemployment, there will then be lost tax revenues, there will then be a depressed community, small businesses in the environment will lose customers because of these workers who have no job anymore. So you as a politician or you as a banker, you are going to be faced with a choice. If you find state money, in the case of a politician, or if you find loanable funds, in the case of a banker, you can be a hero in this community by enabling the worker co-op to have these people keep their jobs, to have this community keep its tax revenues, to prevent small businesses from dying for lack of customers, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Or, Mr. Politician and Mr. Banker, you can become the villain of the piece. You can be the one who doesn't come forward with financial help. And the community, we will make sure, understands that your refusal to provide to these workers the kinds of support you always provided to capitalist enterprises led you to deny the community what it needs. You are the culprit. You are the bad guy. And if I were you, Mr. Politician, I wouldn't be expecting to be reelected having made this choice that you have chosen to make. And Mr. Banker, I would not expect you to be looked on kindly by a community you let down because of your unwillingness to enable these workers to keep this business going when you could have made that decision. Mm-hmm. If you put all these kinds of arrangements together, I think what you would quickly discover is that many workers who have lost their jobs when businesses downsized or closed or moved abroad or had an initial family owner close it because they couldn't find someone to keep it going, that there were millions of people and millions of jobs that could have been protected, could have been preserved, could have been maintained had you made the decision to try to build a worker co-op, and that it would be tragic to not learn from this sad history so that we don't repeat it.
Well, a caller wants to know, what do you think of nationalizing the banks in the United States?
Well, here's one way to get the money available for worker co-ops in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
To nationalize the banks, to make the banks part of the state apparatus, means that you could then direct their lending activities to a much more productive social benefit, namely keeping jobs for people, keeping people in jobs, keeping the jobs, generating the incomes and the tax revenues that keep our society going.
What?
And, you know, there's another reason to have public banking, and that is that the private banks have really shown us in the last 3 or 4 years that they're not to be trusted and that they really have lost their right to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example. We've had billions of dollars, billions with a B, paid in fines and criminal proceedings and civil proceedings by banks who have, in effect, admitted to money laundering, have admitted to manipulating interest rates, the so-called LIBOR scandal in London, admitted to mishandling the whole mortgage crisis that exploded in 2008, to charging excessive fees. Currently, we are coming to the head of proceedings in which banks have admitted to manipulating illegally foreign exchange rates. Literally, every single activity that private banks have acted in, the major banks have shown themselves to be acting in an illegal or unethical way. If we had ever seen this kind of behavior by a public institution, you could have heard everywhere the demand that they be privatized because they have lost their right to do this in a public institutional way. Well, if that logic applies in that direction, then it ought at least to apply as effectively in the other direction. When the private enterprise of banking misbehaves in the way that has now been proven, and which these banks have accepted by the humongous fines that they have had to pay, that is more than enough argument to indicate that private banking is too important in our economy to be left in the hands of an institution that has shown itself to have violated the public trust in more ways than most of us can count.
Well, maybe they should jail a few bankers like they did in Iceland.
Yeah, the problem is only if you jail the banker and you don't change the system.
Right, right.
The person who replaces the banker you put in jail ends up making similar decisions because they're under the similar systemic pressures to do so. And so unless you have the idea that you're going to keep circulating people into jail, you're not going to solve your problem that way. And it's, again, as we have such a hard time in the United States recognizing that the problem is the system and not just the particular person who occupies this or that position in the system.
Well, speaking of the system, you know, one thing I want to talk about a little bit, you know, is that while Greece is having this horrible austerity inflicted on us, getting boatloads of migrants from fleeing wars and deprivation and everything else, and I just saw this report that came out recently. It's called Honest Accounts with a question mark, and it's sort of funded by Friends of the Earth in Africa, the Jubilee Campaign, War on Want, a whole bunch of different groups. Basically, what this report says is that Africa, you know, is actually losing money. The system is sucking money out of Africa. And they go into detail just how this happens. But the sort of the takeaway point is that Africa gets, I guess every year, they get $134 billion coming in, but $192 billion is leaving. So there's a net loss of $58 billion every year. So in a way, Africa is sort of sustaining Europe and America, you know, and the West. And the people there are suffering, and they are coming to the West. And we have a similar situation here with Central America, the product of all the wars we fought. So have you seen this report? It just came out, I think.
No, but I have seen so many of these reports over the years. You know, it used to be the standard criticism of colonialism in the days when Britain and France and Germany and all had colonies around the world, that when you sat down as an economist to look at the figures of what went in and what went out, that the colonies were there to serve the quote-unquote mother country, the country that had taken over that place, and they made sure that that country was more of a provider of resources to the mother country than the other way around, so that you had, as the basic way these economies were set up, that they be net exporters of wealth to the countries that had taken over. Basically, the imperial countries wanted the colony to pay for being a colony. They wanted it to pay that they had spent the time and money to set up the colony. They wanted to make money off of it through the rest of its time as a colony. And so you had this kind of perverse flow in which the poor subsidized the rich, the parent companies, the countries making money off of countries that needed help, not to provide help to countries that were already much richer than they were. So I'm not surprised that this has continued. The independence movements of the old former colonies were not geared to fundamental economic change. They were interested in becoming independent countries. And so they became independent, but because they hadn't changed their economic systems, they ended up still doing what the report you just cited shows, namely providing a net flow of resources.
Whoops.
Did business mm. with. Mm-hmm. And so you had a kind of perverse flow of wealth that is. It really is a tragedy and only makes it worse. And, of course, how can we then be surprised that in the poverty that results in these poor parts of the world to begin with, people with some kind of desire to make a better life take their lives into their hands, crossing the Mediterranean these days, for example, and trying to get to Europe so they can have a chance at a decent life. This is not a solution. This kind of movement of migration, something nobody wants, including the migrants themselves, who take the most chances. But they're responding to a world, a capitalist world, I might say, that develops wealth so unevenly. And, you know, at one point they're making wealthy people at other poor, that you can't be surprised with this conclusion.
You know, I think it was back in the 70s, there was this novel that came out, caused quite a stir. And the idea of the novel was that a whole lot of people from Africa were able to commandeer a freighter or some kind of a ship. And they sailed it right up into the French Riviera and all got out and kind of came ashore. And, you know, the novel is all about how the governments in Europe try to deal with this situation. And I don't know, that novel caused a little bit of a stir. I think it was back in the 70s, but I don't even remember the name of it now. But it was kind of it was very prophetic in a way.
Pierre, I'm afraid, though, I have to sign off because I have another media event, a TV program I'm on that I have to get to. So what I would like to suggest is that let's set up a time we can continue this conversation and go into depth on some of these topics. They're very important, and I don't want to have to cut them off, but I do have another engagement I have to go to.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Professor Richard Wolff, and I guess we will keep this conversation going in the future. Thank you very much for being with us. Well, we have a few minutes left. I don't know. We people can call in with their ideas of austerity. We are having austerity kind of imposed on us here in this country. You know, the wages haven't gone up for most people now since 30 years or so. Wages are, you know, finally people have been striking back with the $15 an hour minimum wage, which is beginning to catch on. And so here we are. I mean, where do you think this economy is going? I think it's, we have about, we only have a few minutes left, but maybe we should try and wrap this up. But to me, the economy seems to be slowly kind of losing its momentum. And I think that part of it has to do with the absence of cheap energy. Cheap energy is what increases productivity. Productivity is what makes for growth. And without growth, debt becomes unpayable. And debt becomes unpayable, the system kind of basically collapses. Well, it can collapse quickly or it can collapse. We have a caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Per. I did a poor job of asking my question earlier. I'm coming from more of like the old left traditional Marxist stance of, you know, we need to have general strikes. We need to shut the country down. I just don't, it seems like, it almost seems like Richard Wolff is defending the continuation of markets and of capitalism. I want to abolish capitalism. And from the old Marxist perspective, I don't see where worker-owned cooperatives fit into that. So,
well, Richard Wolff is a Marxist himself. I mean, that's maybe more so than I am. But anyway, I think it's, you know, even say if you, even if you do have a workers' co-op, it would seem to me that it, at least for a while, it's going to have to deal with a market economy. I mean, say you have a, you know, you have a kind of a food co-op or something like that. You still have to, you have to, you know, buy and sell within this market economy, and at least keep your head above water. So,
well, what would you say to like just a classical Marxist, where you criminalize profit, you criminalize private property, you set up a dictatorship of the proletariat, you establish rationing, you establish production quotas? To me, that's traditional Marxism, and that's what we're desperately in need of now.
Really? Well, I don't know. I kind of wonder how well it would work. It would seem to me that, you know, it's... Wait, we have about 2 minutes left, so I really can't say much about it. But
have a good day, Per.
I don't know. It's kind of... I don't know. I'm skeptical of how well it would work. You can't just say, well, we're going to outlaw this and you will produce that. It's, you know, it's kind of a, you can't just command nature to do what you want it to. And so that's my feeling there. But, you know, there are workers' co-ops that have been very successful. There's the Mondragon co-ops in Spain, which was started back in the, I believe, back in the 50s. They started small, but they have grown. It's become kind of a, I don't know, I wouldn't want to call it an empire, but they have created all kinds of businesses that work on a cooperative model. And they've had their problems, like any business. Sometimes they go broke, but some other business comes up, and they have been sustaining themselves now ever since the 50s. So this is one model. You've had co-ops in Argentina that started back in their troubles back about 10 years ago, and some of those are still going on. So, you know, I don't think that capitalism didn't happen in a day, and I don't think capitalism will be overthrown in a day. I think it'll be sort of a new economy will grow out from under the old, and that's sort of, I don't know, that's sort of my prognostication for right now, but it is 9:59, and so we've had a very interesting show, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
Tune to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned to 10:15 for Flashpoints. Today, a report on Brazil, where protesters are reportedly calling for the impeachment of the president. Also, analysis of Black Lives Matter and the recent dialogues they've had with presidential candidates. Oil expert Antonio Yuhas also is on the show, confirming that the war in Iraq was actually fought for oil and not for freedom. And at 11 o'clock, we've got the food show coming up with Chris Siegel and Rachel Bennett. They speak with Kristen Olson, author of The Soil Will Save Us, with Rich, and also with Richard Setnick of Dick